The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Smaller group this morning, so we'll go ahead and get started. I see a lot of faces that I've been seeing over and over this week, but I'll introduce myself just in case, on the off chance that there's somebody in here who is just arrived in Durham this morning. My name is John Mays. I teach science and math at Regent School of Austin. I've been teaching there 11 years, and I have a passion for math and science and for helping students master it and for helping us all figure out how to integrate our presentation in our classroom in a way that's consistent with the overall goals of a classical curriculum, a classically oriented pedagogy. Very central to this enterprise, I believe, is writing lab reports. And I think this is a key place where the overall goals of the school, oriented around a classical pedagogy, can be integrated into the science class. So that's my topic for this morning. Here's a little outline of what we're gonna do. First, I'm going to present a justification for why students should write their lab reports from scratch, as opposed to using what I used when I was in school and what many schools apparently still use, even classical ones. Don't feel embarrassed if that's you. I'm just going to try to talk you out of it. But a lot of schools still use publisher, lab manuals that come with the book, or go with the book. Basically, a fill-in-the-blank sort of approach. Perhaps tables already there, graphs already there. Students just plot points, fill-in-the-blanks, answer some questions. I'm going to argue that we shouldn't be doing that. Second, we'll go through basic content that should be in a lab report. That's obviously, a little debatable. I was talking with someone yesterday about, my practice and my example lab reports of listing the equipment list, graduated cylinders and beakers and everything all on the list. And the gentleman was suggesting that that wasn't really necessary. That's fine. There are reasons, I think, that you can make the case either way. But I'm going to present a basic outline of what content should be in a lab report. And finally, and probably most importantly, is what are the barriers students face for writing these reports? I have 9 of them, and they're all significant. And as teachers, if we don't enable students to get past these barriers, their lab reports are going to stink. So it's really important that we figure out, give them the tools they need. So let's begin with why should students write lab reports from scratch. Classical education is inherently language-based education. Right. If you think about it, this is one of the key things that defines us as image bearers, God's image bearers. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? It's our distinctive mark. It means we love in a way other creatures don't love. It means we create art in ways other creatures do not. But it also means we communicate in ways other creatures do not. know, language for us is central to our humanity, and language is central to classical education. This is nothing new, right? The whole Trivium is about language. So, writing lab reports, we're using language. And it's therefore very closely, it's a place for close alignment between the overall classical objectives of the school and what we're doing in science. Oh, I'm a little ahead of that. But, of course, the lab report is an encounter with these language goals. You cannot write a good report unless you can express yourself clearly, write logically, persuasively, thoroughly. These are all things that we'll talk about in a little more detail in a moment, but it's obviously a language use endeavor to write a lab report. I'm going to talk about it right here. One of the things I really emphasize in my science classes, and students at first, they don't appreciate what I'm doing. They don't appreciate what I'm doing here. They're used to maybe getting away with answers that kind of sound right. They have all the right buzzwords in them, but they're kind of sloppily formed. And the teacher might look at it and go, well, that's a fair effort. It wasn't expressed very well. It's not bad. I'll give them credit for it. Well, when they arrive in my class, I don't give them credit for those kind of answers. Or I might give them partial credit, but scientists have to communicate their ideas to one another. If you don't communicate clearly, other people don't know what you're talking about. And it's an objective for my class that students are learning to articulate clearly what it is they're trying to say. I hold them accountable for doing this on quizzes as well as in a lab report. Every time they write a sentence in my class, I'm looking for clarity. It's okay if they use more words than they need to. Some students are very verbose. It's okay if they're very efficient, succinct in their use of language. Some students are very efficient and can say a lot with only a few words. I'm not looking so much for quantity, but I am looking for clarity. Ambiguity is the pain that we should fight in scientific writing. If people don't know what you mean, then you haven't succeeded as a scientist in communicating your ideas. The second, when you're expressing a piece of scientific research, other people are going to want to validate or replicate your work. I mean, this, in the big picture, this is where we're trying to train our students to go, is to think the way scientists think. And science is a large community of people who are all looking at one another's work, reading each other's papers, and experiments are going on all the time that are trying to replicate or validate or build on what someone else has done somewhere else. If your description is not thorough, things important, essentials are missing, other people won't know what you did. They won't be able to build on your work. Of course, you're the teacher, and you read someone's report, and you're thinking, wow, you left out this huge thing. I mean, it's so important that this should have been there, you didn't even mention it. So part of the process is teaching students what needs to be in there. Make sure you hit on this. There's always some special things every time we do a lab report that I want to see it, and I know from history that the students tend to leave that out. I'm very careful to mention the students every time. Make sure your report includes a passage about so-and-so, because that's a major part of this exercise. The report also needs to be logical. Of course, in high school, we assume that the logical faculties are starting to really take shape. Nevertheless, we can all be slobs if we want to. And I'm thankful that people in my past didn't allow me to be the slob that I might have naturally tended to be. My mom made me clean up my room. It was a good thing, even though it was, at the time, annoying. Well, it's important that a lab report be written logically. There's an order to follow. Here's an example of how this would break down. If a student is doing one of the labs we do in my ninth grade science class every year, called the pickup truck lab. We get my pickup truck out in the parking lot, we have some force measurement, sensors on the back, we lay marks and tape out on the pavement, we get the timer with a stopwatch, we start the truck from rest, and guys are pushing on the back, and it accelerates as they push on it with a constant force, and then we plot acceleration versus force, and the slope of the line is one of the mass. And we predict what the acceleration should be using F equals MA for different forces. And then we calculated what it was based on the time to accelerate through this interval. And then we could compare experimental and predictive values. It's a great experiment. It gives me to push my truck around the parking lot. If a student starts in his report and the first mention of the truck uses the definite article, the. Right away, I'm telling the students, your report mix is not logical here. You can't say the truck, because your reader is thinking, what truck? What truck are you talking about? The first time you mention the truck, you can't say the truck. The first time you mention it, you have to say a truck. Somewhere before this, you have to say, the general idea here is that we push the truck around in a parking lot. We time how fast it can move. Once you said that, then later you can say, the truck did this, or the truck did that, or we pushed the truck. It just doesn't make any logical sense to start referring to things very specifically using definite articles if you haven't introduced them somewhere in a more general fashion using indefinite articles earlier in the report. That's just one, you know, that's the tiniest little detail I can think of. But obviously, the overall structure needs to be logical too. Okay, next. I think it's an important thing. Why is it that writing essays is such a valuable learning experience? It's because students are synthesizing for themselves ideas using language. It's about the hardest task there is. It's the highest cognitive task. You know, there's a hierarchy, what's it called? Bloom's taxonomy. Some of you be familiar with that? It's like it's a taxonomy of six or seven levels. The lowest level is the knowledge level. I know F equals MA. Okay, great, you know that. Then the next level is understanding. You understand F equals MA. That's understanding because I know things can have zero, if they have zero acceleration, that must mean there's no force. So I understand. Next level is analysis. Next level is application, and I apply this. Next level is, I think, evaluation, making judgments. And then the top level, the highest cognitive level, is synthesis, constructing knowledge based on other things you already know. Now you're going to put things together for yourself and lay it out. Well, that's what you have to do to write an essay. That's what you have to do to write a lab report. It's the highest level of cognitive activity. It takes our students up, way up from the level of just knowledge or even application, mid-level skill and our activity. And it forces them to operate up at the highest cognitive level. In science and math, we have precious few opportunities to push students up to that top level because we don't have as many opportunities to have them write things as they do in literature or history. This is an opportunity for that. I think that for real learning to occur, this construction task has to be happening in the mind. In physics, my regimen in physics, my senior physics class is basically lecture for 2 days and then go away for about a week and then give them a test. I mean, I'm being a little. hyperbolic. But I give them a massive problem assignment. I teach the whole chapter in 2 days of lecture, and then I just bury them in problems and say, have fun. Because the problems all look easy when Mr. Mays works them on the board. And everybody in class goes, oh, golly, I get that. Wow, physics is great. And then they go sit down and try to work the problems, and whoa, okay, they can't figure it out. And now this is when the questions start up. Now learning starts. No, learning wasn't happening before. We were just entertaining ourselves watching Mr. Mace solve these problems, okay? Now learning is gonna start. I wish I had a sign over the door of my classroom that said, nobody ever learns anything in Mr. Mace's class. I want that up there because it means, tongue-in-cheek, the learning doesn't happen when you're listening to me. The learning happens when you're burning the midnight oil at your desk, trying to work these problems for yourself. Because the first time you try it, you will realize you don't know how to do this after all, even though it did look easy in class. So now you start looking through your notes, you start realizing, ooh, I don't really get vector components, or I don't, whatever it is. And now you start digging in, you're constructing now. You're constructing knowledge, you're building. You have to build up the knowledge that it takes to work this problem out. And you have to sustain it. And then you have to do it again and again and again. This is what makes students active learners. If you're passive, I argue very little learning is actually happening if the student is passive. That's what we do when we watch TV. Or those who do watch TV, that's what they do. They're passive and they're on the chair. Learning is different. We have to be active with our minds, and that means we're constructing. That's the way, that's the metaphor I like to use for it. So, that means filling in the blanks in a lab manual is inadequate. It does not put students into this mode of construction the way writing a report does. It keeps them down at the knowledge level, or perhaps the understanding level, the bottom couple of levels in Bloom's taxonomy. That's where you're operating if you're filling in the blanks. If you're writing the report yourself, you're way up here at the synthesis level. Let's think about what students have to do in order to write a report. What are the construction tasks that have to take place? I thought of quite a few of them. Okay. We have to write paragraphs describing our purpose for this experiment, theory behind it, procedures we used. By the way, describing procedures, I remember when I was in fifth grade, we did this exercise in my public school class on writing procedure. And you had to write a description of how to fold a paper airplane. And then a student in the front of the room would do what you wrote exactly the way they perceived your sentences. They would do what you said. And then when you get to the end, if the paper airplane was as you intended it, then your procedures were well articulated. And if you ended up with, a disaster, then obviously you weren't clear in articulating your procedures. It was a great thing to do at the grammar school level. I think all our schools should be doing things like that. I don't want to do that in high school, but I want to depend on the fact that someone else has been able to go through that at an earlier age. They have to be both logical and thorough. This requires thought when you're writing, is to think, how logically am I doing this? Where do I put this statement versus some other statement? And have I said enough? You have to, for yourself, figure out what the graph's going to look like, which variable goes on which axis, unlike in a publisher's manual, it's already told you that F goes down here and A goes up there, the units are already written and everything. If you're writing this for yourself, you have to think, which one of these is the independent variable? Which one's the dependent variable? What are the units? Where do they go on the axis? You have to figure all that out for yourself. Ditto for figuring out your tables. How do you lay out a table? I've got multiple columns. I've got all this data, many trials. how do I process, how do I package this? They have to think through this. They have to build these tables. One of my favorite pet peeves, all right? So we do an experiment like the pickup truck lab that I described, and everybody knows that the times for the time trials are important data that need to go on a table. Yeah, well, what about the weight of the truck, which I gave them, and the distance between the timing tapes on the pavement, which was 10 meters? That needs to... There are these miscellaneous data that are part of the exercise. They have to be reported in the report, too. You have to remember to do that if you're building the report from scratch. Units of measure. Every number in the science class almost is a measurement, and every measurement except angle measures and radians have units of measure. One of my favorites. You don't have to fuss over the details of what this report looks like. We want it to look professional. We don't want it to have all kinds of different fonts and bolds and, you know, weird margins and stuff. We want everything to look good. They have to fuss over those things. When you're writing the procedure, there's a lot of things that you maybe want to omit or simply say we repeated steps 3 through 5 for the next solution or something like that. There are also key things you want to include. They need to indicate to me that they were careful to measure the liquid in the graduated cylinder using the bottom of the meniscus. They need to indicate to me that they know about parallax error and they were careful to avoid it. They need to indicate to me that they calibrated the device, if you're using, say, a triple beam balance, before they started making their measurements. They need to talk to me by telling me that they are aware of these things and they were careful about them. All right, so I want to see that in there. That's what, at the ninth grade level, those are the kind of things that we need to see from our students, just so they know, show you they know what they're talking about. As they get older, we can forget about some of those introductory, basic, so elementary things and concentrate on more sophisticated things. But there's also a lot of things I don't want to see in the procedure. There's no point in telling me, we carried the weigh-boat to the table, we picked up the salt dispenser, and we turned the salt dispenser upside down. Okay, whoa. Just say you put salt in on a triple beam and measured it, okay? Or one of my favorites is, all right, so Newton's second law is F equals ma. And then we did some algebra so that we could get A equals F over M, or A equals 1 over M times F. And I always tell them, why are you telling me, then we did some algebra? Just say, which can be written, A equals 1 over M times F. You don't need to tell me that you did algebra. It's not like a team exercise. Okay, it's time to do algebra now. That can be omitted. To a ninth grader, these things are not obvious. That's the point. We have to help them see what's needed, what's not. And in your conclusion, discussion section at the end, it's very easy to write discussion sections that do not adequately talk about what happened. And so we need to, as writers, decide how much do I need, what things were important to discuss in our results. And all these tasks are tasks that require students to operate up here at the synthesis level where they're constructing knowledge for themselves by the writing process. Okay, finally, if you were in my talk yesterday, you saw my chart with the 21 tools of science learning. Subjected to it again, but for those who were bothered by the way the chart filled in yesterday like this, all over the place, because you're a very linear person, today I'm going to do it for you, okay? So we'll just sit back and read them as they come in, think about them, but we'll fill in the chart. several of these tools in my list of 21 tools are very difficult to address except in the context of a lab report writing assignment or specific ones. So compiling tables, graphs, what's the middle one there? The middle one is about publishing, so that's all about writing your conclusions. Using computer tools, of course, there are other times when we use computer tools, but writing a lab report is the biggest one. And then using graphs to compare your predicted values with your experimental values, which is a common thing in physics and chemistry, less so in biology. Nevertheless, there aren't that many other occasions where you can work on that except in the context of a lab report. Okay, so that's my apologia for why our students should all be writing lab reports. By the way, one question people always ask me is, how many of these do you make your kids write every year? Because it's a time-consuming assignment. In my ninth grade class, we do 5 or 6 during the year. They have 3 in the fall and 3 in the spring, usually. And I try to space them out. And my deadlines are flexible. The students like this. They know to use tasks. This report's going to be 3 or 4 pages long, probably. And I tell them, you know, I don't really care when we turn them in. When would be a good day for you? Let's look at your calendar. How much time do you need? Of course, they always say, well, Christmas. Well, no, let's don't wait till Christmas. I'm thinking in terms of 10 days, 2 weeks. Is that enough? You know, what day would be good? And so they appreciate the fact that I'm setting the deadline based on their schedules, rather, because it doesn't connect with any testing schedule or anything like that. All right, so let's go through the format for a moment, just quickly. So there is a sort of academic standard for scientific writing. We're introducing them to that. And we need to, I would argue that you can't improvise until you learn the basics. A musician that hasn't really learned how to play the basics and gets up and starts trying to improvise, you know, like Dizzy Gillespie or something, you know, is going to just botch it. Let's get down the basics first. So I teach a standard report format that follows the same sequence every time. After they master that, if they want to, as a virtuoso now, use different formatting, then that's good. That's what masters do. But let's master it first. Scientific publications, which is kind of what we're aiming at here, they have standards for how tables and graphs and so on are supposed to look. So our requirements for them for how they present tables, graphs, the labels and titles that go with their tables and graphs, the punctuation that's used in those labels and titles, I'm very picky about those things. So I require the students to comply with a very picky standard about how the label, like table 1, period, and the title, experimental data, 1 capital at the beginning, no other capitals anywhere else in the title, and a period at the end, that's the standard way of doing it. And nobody would do it that way if you just said, write a title. That's not what their default would be. You can tell them. That's how it's typically done. So do it that way. That's the way I want them to see it. Okay, so here's the basic sections, and with some comments about what goes in them. In an article in the journal, you wouldn't have a heading, but this is a report that's happening in a school, and I need to know who you are and what date this was, so let's have a heading. Second is the abstract. I just started doing this a couple of years ago. It hadn't dawned on me until recently that abstracts would be a good thing to teach students how to write, but only upper-level students. So we, in our junior and senior courses, that's where we teach students how to write an abstract. And below that, we don't worry about it. It's good, though, because they're going to have to write abstracts very soon. So we might as well. It's not hard. It's just, it just takes a little getting used to it. Third, then we have the purpose of the experiment, and an important item here is the students always want to say something like, to learn about Newton's second law of motion. And I always emphasize to them, well, yeah, you're in a school, and the purpose is for you to learn about Newton's second law of motion. I want you to pretend that you're writing this report for publication. You're not going to say that. We need to hear about the scientific purpose, not the pedagogical purpose. The scientific purpose is to use Newton's theory of acceleration to make predictions about what will happen to an object when forces are applied to it, and then to compare those predictions to experiment. That's the experimental result. That's the scientific purpose, and that's the way I encourage the students to articulate their purpose statement. Not, you know, we can learn about this. Fourth section would be the background section. Will come up again, barriers, but their students have no idea what to say in the background section. And some students will end up giving you three or four sentences, and you're sitting there thinking, there was at least 300 words of stuff that needed to be said here, and you gave me 20. So I have organized for the students four specific things that need to be in the background section. If you tell them this, they will bless you. They will go, oh, that's what you want me to talk about. Okay, let's start off with a little bit of history. After all, this is a classical school. We love history. So you're doing a lab about Newton's laws of motion, maybe a couple of sentences about who Isaac Newton was and when the Principia was published, it would be helpful so that you can contextualize the theory that we're working with here. Or if you're in a more sophisticated context, maybe with juniors or seniors, and you're trying to do a lab that builds on some prior work, maybe the ancient history isn't so important, but a description of that prior work would be. We need that in our background, and that's where we start off. The second thing we need in the background is a review of the theory involved. This includes all of the equations that we will use, the units of measure involved. If part of the lab is to look for certain trends, linear trends, quadratic trends, exponential trends, you should discuss in the theory section the nature of these variables. If you've got an equation you're looking at, like you write f equals ma, and then you say, which can be written, n equals 1 over m times f, here's where you say, represented this way, the force will be the independent variable, and the acceleration will be the dependent variable, and the coefficient proportionality will be 1 over the mass. And if our experimental results are consistent with this theory, we would expect the data to form a line, be linear, and the slope of that will be 1 over the mass. If they say all those things, they get this. They get the F equals MA equation. That's what I want them to describe. Third is an overview of the experimental setup. I mentioned this before. You can't jump into procedure and say the truck, because the reader's going to go, what truck? You didn't tell me we had a truck. Let's begin here by just giving us two or three sentences overview. The experimental idea is to push a pickup truck in the parking lot using, you know, measuring the forces applied, timing the truck, and using the time values to measure the acceleration. One sentence, the reader has the general idea. When we get to the procedure section, the details will make sense. And finally, in physics and chemistry, you are typically trying to use theory to make a prediction, predicted values of some kind, and you're going to compare your experimental results to that. So we need a hypothesis to articulate what you think is going to happen. on an experiment like the pickup truck lab that I'm using as an example, they would probably say something like, our team's hypothesis was that the experiment, that the acceleration value would vary in direct proportion to the force values. Okay, so, good. Now, in the discussion section later, that's what we're going to talk about, that hypothesis. And in fact, this should be even a little more specific with constant proportionality equal to 1 over n. All right, so the next section is the procedure. I don't think I need to say much more about this. It's very easy to be overly verbose here. So the idea is to teach them to be thorough but efficient. And then we have the results section. The results section doesn't need to have very much text in it at all, but they do. This is where they report their experimental data. This is where they present it. But they can't just plop a graph there, okay? It is unacceptable to just have a graph on a page, or say a table of data on a page without a statement that refers the reader to it explicitly in the text. So all you need is one sentence. The experimental data are shown in table one. And then right under that it says table one, period, capital, experimental data, period. And then there's a table. Right, so that would be the minimum that we would have in the results section. I always tell them, don't tell me anything about why anything happened or what you think about it. That comes next. In this section, all you're telling me is what happened. That's the data and any other observations you made while the lab is running that you need to report. That's what goes here in the results section. Next is our discussion, and this is, of course, the heartbeat of the lab report. So, once again, students have a real hard time knowing what to write about in here, so I give them four heads to think through, and I tell them it's probably best at this point if you follow these in this order, although I'm not strict about it, it will help you organize your thoughts if you stick to this order. Later, as you mastered this, if you want to mix things up around a little bit, that's fine. You know what you're doing by then. But before you do anything else, the first thing you should do is, in your discussion, is present to the reader the predicted values that you're going to use to compare your results to. Then, if the report includes any graphs, present those. On the pickup truck lab that I'm referring to, in that experiment, I have them calculate the predicted values, and then we get the experimental values, and then we plot them on the same set of axes. And the predicted ones, of course, if the calculations are correct, will be in a perfect line. And the experimental ones, hopefully, will be close to that line and not exhibit a trend other than linear trend more or less along this line. We've got a good experimental setup going. Some years it's better than others. We try to find out what happened this year. Oh, we did it over there instead of over there. The parking lot sloped over there, so the whole graph is off. So we always learn a little year by year how to do it better. But that's what comes next. All right, the third thing is now we need to talk about the difference between our experimental values and the predicted values, which at the school level is typically called experimental error. And that's what I call it. And in my lab report handbook, which many of you have already looked at, that's what I call it in there too. However, we should be aware as science teachers that that's not what scientists call it. Scientists call it the difference between your experimental results and the predictions. Okay? Experimental error is a thing you shouldn't have. If you make errors, you should go correct them and do the experiment over again. You don't say, well, we made errors, but here's the results. Go do the experiment without errors and then give me the results. And talk about the difference between your experimental results and your prediction. That's the way scientists talk. But the term experimental error and the equation we use to calculate it, predicted value minus experimental value, with predictive value, absolute value, times 100%. That's in every science book in the nation. I didn't really feel like taking all that on. So, fine, that terminology is not bad, but we should be aware of it. It's limited utility. It works fine. But that's the next thing we should calculate, is the experimental error. And then finally, we need to discuss what caused the error as best as we can. The error discussion needs to be more sophisticated the older the student is. The error discussion needs to be about factors that could have caused the error that you have. If you have a 20% error, you can't say, well, we might have some error measuring the distance between the tapes on the ground that we're going to use to measure the truck's acceleration. All right, how far are those tapes apart? 10 meters. Well, how far would you have to be off on that to get a 20% error? Do you think it's possible that you were that far off measuring? No, you measured that to the nearest fraction of a centimeter. Well, there's no way you got 20% error from that. So, get rid of it. Tell me something that might have caused 20% error. Oh, well, the boys pushing on the back, the force meters are going all over the place. Okay, well, that's a place where you could get some error, not the measurement between the things. So the last thing that needs to go in the discussion is revisit your hypothesis and talk about whether it was confirmed or not. Because this is a basic action in the scientific enterprise. You start with a theory, you make predictions from the theory. Now we're going to test those predictions, the hypothesis. We're going to test it. The outcome of this experiment is either going to confirm or not confirm that hypothesis. So that's what you need to talk about now. Did it confirm it or not? That's a hard thing to say because you've got error. So how much error is enough that means we didn't confirm it? Okay, I'm going to real quickly, last two sections obviously are a conclusion where you talk about the general success or lack of success of the experiment. A thing I tell students here to talk about is, do you think your results were definitive? One way or the other, do they look definitive to you or do they look ambiguous to you? If they look definitive, you should probably call your experiment a success. If they don't, then you might want to say, our results were ambiguous, this thing needs to be done over again with these changes. And then finally, we need a reference section using industry standard formatting. In my lab report handbook, I present two different styles of footnoting that are used in the standard science journals, Nature, Science, and so on. And I tell my students, well, pick one or the other, but use one of those standard ones. And it's not the same as NLA, per se, using other courses. Now let's go to the barriers students face. Many of these I already referred to, so I won't dwell on them again. But I've got 9 of them here. First, I already mentioned this, they tend to not be clear what the purpose of the experiment is, and they want to articulate an educational purpose rather than a scientific purpose. I already discussed that, but I just put it here for completeness. Second, they are unfamiliar with technical writing style. They've been told all their lives by their English teachers to use a different adjective every time they're describing the color of that plant. Sometimes it's green, celery green, emerald green. Mix it up. This is creative writing. And as scientists were going, wait, those are all different colors. Which one is it? Use the same adjective every single time. I want this paper to be so boring that a poet would just go to sleep. I am a poet. But right now I'm a science teacher, and I won't go to sleep. But you will very much confuse me if your adjectives are bouncing all over the place, because an adjective means something to me, and if you switch it on me, I think you mean something different. They've never heard this before. This is the first time they've ever heard this when they get into high school, that I should deliberately write like this. So we need to teach them. Of course, there are whole courses on tech writing in college. We're just introducing them to some of these basic principles. I already mentioned that one of our fundamental goals in science, as science teachers, is to teach students to express themselves clearly so that there's no ambiguity. That's hard for them. They need to learn how to do that. They need to sequence their ideas logically, as I've talked about already. They need to be thorough in their descriptions, and they need to use appropriate tenses and voices. Their English teachers have told them, since they were old enough to know the difference, never use the passive voice. We hammer it in. But when you're writing the procedure section in a lab report, you probably need to use the passive voice. In fact, I know some college lab report guys that I looked at online require passive voice in the procedure section. This will flip the students out. You want me to say the beakers were emptied and, the experiment was repeated? Yes, I want you to say beakers were emptied and the experiment was repeated. Passive voice. It works in that section. And tenses are also drive the students crazy. They tend to write in the future tense. The team will do this and that. And I always tell them, wait, you already did this experiment, so we probably use the past tense in your verb, you need to agree, and every now and then you will want to refer to something in the present tense, like Newton's second law, which still says what it always has said, but this takes practice. They have a lot of trouble with vocabulary. That's fine. This is their opportunity to start practicing on using technical vocabulary. So first of all, let's just kill pronouns. Just get rid of them. We don't want to see any theys or its or them. It what? The truck? The pusher of the truck? The road the truck is on? I can't quite tell what you're talking about. It was sloping. Okay, I think you mean the road, but maybe the truck was sloping. Maybe the boy who was pushing it was sloping. Who's sloping here? Kill pronouns. Second, students frequently tend to misuse technical terms. They say, that curve is an asymptote. No, it's not. The curve is heading toward the asymptote. It isn't the asymptote. There are asymptotes that perhaps might be curved. We don't usually study them in high school. Slang is very common for students. Here's just a few examples that I pulled out of my head of slang. We do a lab with pendulums, measure the period of the pendulum. They always want to say, we let the thing go. Don't say let go, say you released it. Then. Instead of saying you fixed up the solution, say you prepared the solution. And nobody thinks of this, but I like to just dig on it a little bit. The lab is the room that we're in. What you're doing right now is an experiment. And although everybody in America calls the report they're going to write a lab report, you and me, nevertheless, let's refer to this exercise as an experiment, not a lab. It's just a better word. It's got three syllables for starters. Okay, they don't know what to say, so I have already gone over this in some detail by the foreheads that I encourage them to write about in the background and the foreheads in the discussion section, but they need to be led to understand what's important to talk about and where to put a limit on all the detail they include in their procedures. The formatting I've already talked about as well, but they kick against this, and it's hard to learn. There are lots of details. So I grade the first lab report in the ninth grade much more leniently. I just want to see that you're paying attention, you're taking some care, you're proofreading your paper, you've got the basic parts there, you're on the right track, that's going to get you an A. On the second lab report, the third lab report, the grading mover gets harder. I need it because there's a lot of detail to learn. Fine, it's going to take us several reports to start learning these things, but the grading standard gets higher every time you go. I want to see that you're starting to learn these details and not overlooking them. For graphs and where to put the other data, you know, these other things, that other miscellaneous information, the weights and whatnot, you have that. Students tend to just plop it on the page. So they're riding along, and here's the table, experimental data, and then they've got these other values. They don't know what to do with them, so they just write them. And like it's just a mystery number in the middle of the page. Like a K on the front of a box of cereal down at the bottom. And we all look at that. Why is that K always there? What does that mean? Well, I don't like mystery numbers. Either put another table and refer to it, or put those values in a sentence. You can't just have a random number on the page. We've talked about content, and of course we want a good appearance. Students do not know how to interpret results until you teach them, and one of the fundamental mistakes they make is assuming that if there's any disparity at all between the experimental value and the predicted value, the results are wrong. There's no such thing as wrong. It's just how much error is there, or even more precisely, how much uncertainty is there in your measurement? So there's uncertainty in the measurement itself, and then there's a difference between that distribution of values you might have gotten and the predicted value. So it's not about wrong and right. In fact, even if your number came out spot on to your predicted value and you thought you had no error at all, well, if you were able to measure things more precisely, you would find that there is a difference in there. An infinite precision is impossible. So there's always a difference. The question is, how much is enough to make you suspect that something's wrong versus that the hypothesis was confirmed? We need to talk about the trends on our graphs. If you are expecting a linear trend, you should discuss whether your trend is linear or not. 2 points on a graph do not tell you what kind of trend you have, and your students should be told that. Even 3 points that have a knee shape, that doesn't mean we have an exponential going on here, right? If you have a 4 point, the knee, it might come back down again. So one of the things I do when I'm designing the experiment is think about this in advance. It would be nice to have 4 data points on our course graph instead of 3, because that will, if we're getting something like that, that means something different. If I have 4 points, then they have the opportunity to zig up and down, and all the students can kind of see that there's a trend that is linear. I discussed this already, but the sources of error they identify need to match. We need to be feasible for the amount of error we have, and we need to talk about how successful the hypothesis was. I'm just going to hurry through this. MLA citation standards are what they know, but that's not what we want to use in the science context, so we introduce them to new standards for citing source material and identifying their figures. I don't know, I hardly ever meet any students that already know how to build a graph in Microsoft Excel when they walk into ninth grade. So I need to teach them how to do that and then how to paste that into Word. They love learning it, but that's a thing, that's a barrier that I have to get over to do this. Just heard through the meetings, that's what I just said. And finally, they do still struggle with their use of standard English, making their verbs agree, making their tenses consistent in the paragraph. You tend to see like 3 or 4 different tenses going on. Will, would, were, are, would. There's just all these tenses are going on. Spelling, even. We should certainly be using a spell checker in these. They're resistant to spending time editing and proofing. But if they don't do that, I don't see the standard of care that I want to see on experimental exercise. exercise. I tell them to read their papers out loud to themselves. That's the best way to find and proofread your point. Most of your mistakes by reading it out loud to your cat or your teddy bear in your privacy of your study. Everybody misses the mistakes when reading them silently on the computer screen. So print it out, read it to your cat as carefully as you can. You'll find some core mistakes. That's one of the reports I graded this past year. It's a beautiful piece of work. I was very pleased to give her a 96 on it. She's just an ordinary kid. And in ninth grade, to write reports that would make any high school teacher proud at any grade level. And what consistently happens if we teach our students how to do this well is they will go to college, they'll be in their lab, in their biology class, their freshman year. The TA will come back in with a stack of reports for the first try and say, these reports are deplorable. Except this one. This one report here is incredible. Where is this person? How did you learn how to write a lab report like that? In high school, where did you go to school? I love this conversation. It happens every year. That's my goal. So, that's the end of my talk. If you don't know about my booth yet, I do have the book on the left, the Lab Report Handbook, specifically written to give students a resource to be able to write reports this way. All the things I talked about today are discussed in there. So, we have, just exactly like yesterday, I have exactly 2 minutes left. So let me get the questions as fast as I can in the back.
You mentioned cheating one time. Do you ever
They elaborate on their work, on their calculations, on their agreement about the results and the percentage of error and all that. But they have to write their own report. There's just no way around. That makes me, I have to grade 4 times as many reports, but every student needs to go through this whole exercise himself every time. Yes?
You mentioned you only have them do this 3 to 5 times a year. I'm assuming you
No, 5 to 6. 5 to 6,
okay. I'm assuming you have more students than that.
Certainly the biology teacher has way more than that. In my physics classes, I have lots of more demonstration-type activities that don't entail the writing of a report. So, many of those. But then 6 times a year, I'm going to give them an exercise to go through, and they're going to take data and go through the whole report writing thing about half of the time.
How many of you do any adjustments to start?
Okay, what we do at our school is, my computer just got taken by my faithful assistant. The Lab Report Handbook, we give that to our ninth graders as a text. They keep it, they use it every year in every science class. In middle school, we give it to our teachers, and they use it as a reference to tell themselves, what are my kids going to face next year or year after next? And then they structure activities in the 7th and 8th grade that are less formal and less rigorous. They're kind of pointing in this direction. So write a procedure or discuss what happened yesterday in class. Okay, little pieces of it. They might even not have them typed. It might be handwritten. That would be up to them. But they use it as a reference to give kids activities that are going to start leading this way. Let's make a graph. Now, let's figure out which variable goes on which axis, because that's part of what we start doing in ninth grade more formally. So, that's what we do.
How can I implement this in an average of every single axis? There's no experimentation?
Okay, in my presentation today, I didn't mention this, but in the report I go into a little more. There are actually really 2 basic kinds of experiments. One is exploratory, which is what you're doing. That's the typical thing for biology. Whereas in physics and chemistry, we tend to make predictions and then test those predictions. So one of the examples that I have in the lab report handbook is a Mendelian genetics type of thing where they explore and discover and present, but there's no hypothesis. You know, it's just. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there was a hypothesis. I don't remember. But anyway, there are descriptive reports where your mission is to discover and present rather than to explain error and things like that. But the content and the setup can be more or less the same. It's just that your discussion section isn't going to focus on the difference between prediction and experiment. It's going to focus more on what did you find and what color was it, what happened when you did see. Next question, there were others? Yes?
I have a question about
my standard is that, as I described yesterday, I get virtually no credit for homework. In ninth grade, 5%. The rest of the grade is 85% is the quizzes, the weekly quizzes, and that leaves 10% for these labs. For seniors, the homework isn't there. So that gives me that 5% to either add into the exams or into the lab reports. I tend to stick with the 10% for the lab reports. That means if we do 3 per term, each report is about 3% of their grade, which is enough to hurt if they do a bad job, but you know, I don't want it to. I want that report to be important. Is there a question to the period? When I first started teaching in 1988, I was a coordinator of the science fair for our school, the public school. It was great. It was also infinitely time consuming for both me and the students. When I started teaching at Regents, having had that experience and saw how great it was, I started thinking, great, well, we have to do the science fair here. Then I started seeing what the workload looks like for a student in a classical school, and I quickly understood that these are incompatible. Their reading and writing load for the humanities courses and Latin and all that is massive. I do not have time to do a science fair project. I limit that. I wish there was a way around it, but I haven't discovered it, so we don't participate in science fair. You can find me at the Navarre Science Map booth. If you have any other questions, I'll be there the rest of the morning. Thank you.